Now, you remember we were considering the question of the diversity of the station, of the manifestations. They have this twofold station. One is the station of absolute oneness. It's an abstract, universal reality in which all the manifestations of God partake. It is the one reality that's reflected in the individuality of the person of the manifestation. But the reality of the manifestation is this all-embracing power. And in one place, Abdu'l-Bahá mentions it as if we were the fish in the ocean of Baha'u'lláh's reality. That is the difference between our station and the station of a manifestation. He is the all-encompassing medium in which we exist and subsist. And like the fish in the sea, they don't know what the water is right away. I mean, you know, they live off it, but they don't realize it's so present, ever-present, that it isn't clear exactly what the role it plays in their life, because they don't know anything else. And in the same way, we are so sustained by the spirit of the manifestation, even the functioning of our digestive system and bloodstream and everything is controlled by spirit, which is at another level, not the personality of the manifestation, but this all-encompassing power of spirit that he represents, that it's all that comes from that higher position. And on the other hand, there's a station of distinction that we saw mentioned on page 176. And he says, in this respect, each manifestation of God hath a distinct individuality, a definitely prescribed mission, a predestined revelation, and specially designated limitations. Each one of them is known by a different name, is characterized by a special attribute, fulfills a definite mission, and is entrusted with a particular revelation. ...177 at the top. It is because of this difference in their station and mission that the words and utterances flowing from these wellsprings of divine knowledge appear to diverge and differ. Otherwise, in the eyes of them that are initiated into the mysteries of divine wisdom, all their utterances are in reality the expressions of one truth. And further down, it hath ever been evident that all these divergences of utterance are attributable to differences of station. Thus, viewed from the standpoint of their oneness and sublime attachment, the attributes of Godhead, divinity, supreme singleness, and inmost essence have been and are applicable to those essences of being, inasmuch as they all abide on the throne of divine revelation and are established upon the seat of divine concealment. Through their appearance, the revelation of God is made manifest, and by their countenance, the beauty of God is revealed. Thus it is that the accents of God Himself have been heard uttered by these manifestations of the Divine Being. Viewed in the light of their second station, the station of distinction, differentiation, temporal limitations, characteristics, and standards, they manifest absolute servitude, utter destitution, and complete self-effacement. Even as he saith, I am the servant of God. I am but a man like you. Now, actually, these are two Arabic verses from the Quran, if you want to take note of them. The first one is Surah 19, verse 31, I am the servant of God. The second one is Surah 18, verse 110, I am but a man like you. Statements of Muhammad in the Quran. Now he says, from these incontrovertible and fully demonstrated statements, strive thou to apprehend the meaning of the questions thou hast asked, that thou mayest become steadfast in the faith of God, and not be dismayed by the divergences in the utterances of his prophets and chosen ones. Now, many of us in the West are familiar with the claims of the Christians and so on. They say, well, Christ said, I am the life giver. I am the way. No one will reach unto the Father except by me. So they say, that's finished. We don't consider anybody else. And yet we realize by this explanation that when he says, I am the life giver, when he says, no one reaches unto the Father except by me, it's the voice of this first station in which all these pronouncements related to God, related to the high station and exclusivity of the manifestation, come from. So any one of the manifestations could say this and it would be true. As he states here on 178 at the bottom, were any of the all-embracing manifestations of God to declare, I am God, he verily speaketh the truth, and no doubt attacheth thereto. For it hath been repeatedly demonstrated that through their revelation, their attributes and names, the revelation of God, his names and his attributes are made manifest in the world. That's the key to the whole question of these very exalted statements of the manifestation in the terms of I am God, or whenever they speak with the voice of God. He hath revealed those shafts were God's, not thine. And also he saith, in truth, they who plighted fealty unto thee, faithfulness unto thee, really plighted that fealty unto God. And were any of them to voice the utterance, I am the messenger of God, he also speaketh the truth, the indubitable truth. Even as he saith, Muhammad is not the father of any man among you, but he is the messenger of God. Though Muhammad had children, he had Fatima, his daughter, but here he's speaking from another stage, another station. So now we have, I am God, I am the messenger of God. Viewed in this light, they are all but messengers of that ideal king, that unchangeable essence. And were they all to proclaim, I am the seal of the prophets, they verily utter but the truth beyond the faintest shadow of doubt. For they are all but one person, one soul, one spirit, one being, one revelation. They are all the manifestations of the beginning and the end, the first and the last, the seen and the hidden, all of which pertain to him who is the innermost spirit of spirits and the eternal essence of essences. And were they to say, we are the servants of God, this also is a manifest and indisputable fact, for they have been made manifest in the uttermost state of servitude, a servitude the like of which no man can possibly attain. Thus, in moments in which these essences of being were deeply immersed beneath the oceans of ancient and everlasting holiness, or when they soared to the loftiest summits of divine mysteries, they claimed their utterance to be the voice of divinity, the call of God himself. Were the eye of discernment to be opened, it would recognize that in this very state they have considered themselves utterly effaced and non-existent in the face of him who is the all-pervading, the incorruptible. Methinks they have regarded themselves as utter nothingness and deemed their mention in that court an act of blasphemy. For the slightest whisperings of self within such a court is an evidence of self-assertion and independent existence. In the eyes of them that have attained unto that court, such a suggestion is itself a grievous transgression. How much more grievous would it be were aught else to be mentioned in that presence? Were man's heart, his tongue, his mind, or his soul to be busied with anyone but the well-beloved? Were his eyes to behold any countenance other than his beauty? Were his ear to be inclined to any melody but his voice? And were his feet to tread any way but his way? Then Baha'u'llah steps out of the theme for a moment, and again he punctuates the text with a statement to place in perspective what's happening right now in this book. In this day the breeze of God is wafted and His Spirit hath pervaded all things. Such is the outpouring of His speech that the pen is stilled and the tongue is speechless. Then he drops back in the text again. By virtue of this station, he goes on to make his explanation. But he tells you what's happening in this day. You know, he adds to the uncle of the Bab. Be aware, awaken to what's going on here. These are the greatest truths that have ever been revealed to humankind. Such passages have never been witnessed before. This is the supreme book. After the Akdas, it is the most exalted book of doctrine from God that's ever been given in recorded history of the human race. And he punctuates, he tells him. Even Baha'u'llah says his pen is stilled and the tongue is speechless when he thinks of the power of the revelation that's pouring through him to reveal this. He goes on to explain. He says, by virtue of this station, they have claimed for themselves the voice of divinity and the light. Whilst by virtue of their station of messengership, they have declared themselves the messengers of God. In every instance, they have voiced an utterance that would conform to the requirements of the occasion, and have ascribed all these declarations to themselves. Declarations ranging from the realm of divine revelation to the realm of creation, and from the domain of divinity even unto the domain of earthly existence. Thus it is that whatsoever be their utterance, whether it pertain to the realm of divinity, lordship, prophethood, messengership, guardianship, apostleship, or servitude, all is true, beyond the shadow of a doubt. Therefore, these sayings which we have quoted in support of our argument must be attentively considered, that the divergent utterances of the manifestation of the unseen and day springs of holiness may cease to agitate the soul and perplex the mind. So here Baha'u'llah gives the key for the reconciliation of all the holy books, in a sense, how to understand these different utterances. We quote Christ and we say, he says, I and the Father are one. And then we quote and we say, Muhammad says, I'm but a man like you. And then we say, Christ is very high and Muhammad is very low. But we have to look at the whole picture. Christ also said, when they said to him, they praised him. He refers to the Father in heaven, refers to his own lowliness, and he refers to the greatness of the Father in heaven. Now the Christians don't know what to make out of all this. They've ended up saying that the Trinity, that the three in one, that's why the three are one in one. So sometimes God speaks, sometimes man speaks, sometimes the Holy Spirit speaks, and if you try to figure out how they're separate, you'll never figure it out. And it's a mystery, and that's the end of it. But Baha'u'llah explains here, why these different utterances? Depends what condition they're addressing people from. Aaron, yes? Trinity is an incorrect definition, because the Father in the Trinity is the essence of God, and He's not one with the prophets. Although the prophets are God for us, in a sense they represent the appearance of God, the shining of His reality and His beauty in the world. There's no access to Him except through the manifestations, yet they're different, very distinctly different. And this is a doctrine that's very important to preserve, Shoghi Effendi said. You know? And when you read some of these things where Baha'u'llah talks about the infinity of material creation, endless galaxies filled with endless solar systems, with stars and planets and creatures and prophets. The one prophet that appears on little earth is going to say, I'm God, and that's the end of it. He's God. He is, partakes of this power. He is a primary mirror of that one reality that's behind all things. You know? But even that inner reality of which he is the immediate reflection is an emanation from God and not God himself. It's the will of God, the first, the world of command, the middle line that, as represented in the ring stone. The world of command, the world of the inner world, the singular world of the Prophet of God. Now I want to quote something here from the Gleanings. This is page 166-67. Some of you have these other collected writings. It's Gleanings section 84, LXXX1V, if you write in that language. Baha'u'llah is explaining about divine unity, the meaning of Tawheed, the meaning of divine unity. The essence of belief in divine unity consisteth in regarding him who is the manifestation of God, and him who is the invisible, the inaccessible, the unknowable essence as one and the same. Now, this is the essence of belief in the divine unity. You believe them as one and the same, and yet you clearly remember there's a distinction in as to regards being itself, you know, as to regards their essence itself. By this is meant, then he explains, that whatever pertaineth to the former, all his acts and doings, whatever he ordaineth or forbiddeth, should be considered in all their aspects and under all circumstances, and without any reservation, as identical with the will of God himself. This is the loftiest station to which a true believer in the unity of God can ever hope to attain. Blessed is the man that reacheth this station, and is of them that are steadfast in their belief. All right, do you have any comments or ideas or thoughts? We should discuss this a little bit. See if this. Well, let us make an example. I hope it's not blasphemous, but let us try this. Let us say that Baha'u'llah comes to the people and he says, here I am. I've been sent by God. My name is Baha'u'llah and I came from Nur. And you should know something about my mother and father. And you know I like rice very much and tea is very good. But this is his personality. This is his person. I like punctuality in all my affairs. I'm very fond of rock candy. And you say, what kind of messenger of God is this? He's talking all about his own things. He could speak that way, and he did sometimes to people, to the Turkish officials and others. He spoke as a man. But he has this other, which is so much more important. Now, at moments, he said, because they have this, they slide between these two, you know. The other is always present. And even when he says, good morning, how are you? Did you sleep well? He says, don't think it's the common expression of the people. He says this in a tablet. He says, it is filled with mysteries and meanings. If the manifestation says this to you, don't take anything he does or says as commonplace, even if he says, have some more tea. It has a meaning. It's everything in his presence, in his reality, has this thing. Now, sometimes the believers have told stories where they show what the meanings were of something like that. I remember Mr. Tarzad, his father, was in his presence. Baha'u'llah served him tea, and he was so overwhelmed that Baha'u'llah was passing him the tea that he spilled some tea on his abba, on his robe. And Baha'u'llah said, be careful, you're spilling your tea. You need this when you go back to Persia. It'll be your only clothing. He forgot all about that in the middle of this. Now when he was in Mecca, Baha'u'llah sent him back with Nabil, with all of his baggage and all kinds of things, back to Mecca. It was hot. They were sleeping up on the roof of a building. And thieves stole all their things. He was in his underwear. Everything was gone. Amongst his things, Baha'u'llah had also given him some of his hair, a lock of his hair. He had this with him, this precious, they stole that too. So Nabil is out telling the police that they've stolen our things and so on, and the police get on the case and they look and they find. After some hours, they said they found, the only thing they found thrown away was this abba with a tea stain, which is no good. And they think that because of that they threw that away. And he says, and there's some hair in the pocket of the abba. So he takes it back and he gives it to Tahir. He has this robe to put on with the tea stain. Then he remembers this thing that Baha'u'llah told him, this will be your only clothing when you return to Persia. I mean, there's all kinds of stories along that sort, but this is why this quotation that we read here from the Gleanings is so important. He says, all his acts and doings, whatever he ordaineth or forbiddeth, should be considered in all their aspects and under all circumstances and without any reservation as identical with the will of God himself. And because there is this identity of the will with everything he does, then it's special. Because not like when we say, good morning, how are you? It's different. How we can understand this, we don't know, because we weren't in his presence. But
when he says, good morning, how are you, there's still a difference between this and between when you really reveal something, right? And when you want, for someone, you call the secretary to write it down.
When he was revealing a tablet, yes?
Was it like that he realized now he has to, he revealed something what has to be written down for others, and then he calls the secretary, or...
He seems to have will also to decide when to reveal. Sometimes he feels the desire and he will dismiss the friends and he would reveal things. Other times he would give guidance to the friends, and that was also the guidance of God. But there are these particular tablets that were revealed, something that's, you know, a work by itself, so to speak. But oftentimes in Nabil and everything, you'll see these accounts of Baha'u'llah told them to do this and gives guidance, you know. Now, if he hadn't written it down and sealed and signed it, it was like a pilgrim note after that. But it was still the guidance of God.
Gleanings number 39, Baha'u'llah is talking about how he's comparing the persecutions of the different prophets and likening himself to the particular station. And but Khomeini seems to be comparing himself with John the Baptist and the Imam Hussein as well.
He has chosen to identify himself in that passage which is from the Suraya Dam, from the Surah of Flood, with not only prophets of God, but some of the holy ones, the chosen ones. And Shoghi Effendi says it doesn't mean they're all prophets of God because they're all in the same list. It's because of the greatness that he attributes to these souls, the spirit of sacrifice of them. For instance, he identifies himself as the return of Imam Hossein. How is this? The greatest supreme manifestation of God identifies himself with the return of the third Imam of the Muslim faith. Why of all these religions, which are all his forerunners, so to speak, he's chosen what we would probably imagine to be a secondary figure? This is because the nature of the sacrifice, the love that God had for Hossein. Each thing in its station can be very great. You know, you can't compare Hossein with Muhammad. But you can compare Hossein with what Hossein was to be, and you maybe find there is an exact closeness. In other words, if you conform yourself to the will of God, you will be very great in the sight of God. And this brings us back to the first question. What about us? And we see in the writings, we see so many places, he says, if we become selfless mirrors of the reality of Baha'u'llah, which shines on us like the sun of truth on our souls, if we can find a way to disengage ourselves from our personality and allow ourselves to be a mirror of his reality, then we will attain the purpose for which we've been created, in the same way that the manifestation transcends his individual and particular circumstances and reveals the word of God. He speaks beyond himself. And when we teach the faith, when we're out teaching the faith, or when we're living the life, we should be thinking in those terms, it seems to me. That the more we can disappear in the face of that presence of the divine names and attributes, the more effective we'll be. And that also makes us humble, as the prophets were humble, to be instruments of such a thing. They are primary mirrors, we're secondary mirrors, or whatever we are, way down the line, I don't know. But still, human reality has been made in the image and likeness of the names and attributes that the prophets of God reveal. We have the capacity to reflect that light to a degree that nothing else in creation has after the manifestations of God. We have created you, ye noble. My light is in thee. So it seems that the reflection of the names and attributes of God in the human station requires humility. And it is a perfection in the human level that's required. I don't know quite how it fits in with the divine names. This question has come up a couple times recently, and I'd like to think about it before I plunge into any answer. Because the manifestations have also shown this face of humility and meekness. He mentions here this utter self-effacement which allows that reality in them to say, I am God, so that they speak to us in the first person. This is very challenging. This is the most challenging thing that the prophets of God do. think of Muhammad. He's come. He says, I'm a man. He said, I have had a vision, and I have seen the angel Gabriel. And Gabriel said to me to tell you that he heard from God, that God wanted him to tell me to tell you this. The message has come from pretty far away. It's not too threatening. How different that is from Muhammad opening his mouth and he says, I am God, and I want you to move from there to there. This is too much for the people. At least it was until now. And now we are coming of age. And for the first time we have a manifestation of God who speaks endlessly from with this voice of God. But he says very clearly what he means by that. You should put down this also as a cross reference, the Epistle to the Son of the Wolf. Put it. I thought I had this with me. Anyway, it's one of these statements that is in The Meaning of Divinity, it's called. And it's in Epistle to the Son of the Wolf. There are many phrases of this sort. In Baha'u'llah's revelation. One thing you could look up is in the tablets of Baha'u'llah, page 52 and 53. This is the fourth tajalli of the tajalliyat. He says the fourth tajalli is concerning divinity, Godhead, and the like. Were a man of insight to direct his gaze towards the blessed, the manifest lotus tree and its fruits, he would be so enriched thereby as to be independent of aught else and to acknowledge his belief in that which the speaker on Sinai hath uttered from the throne of revelation. A bit further on he says, by the righteousness of God, but for the anthem of praise voiced by him who heralded the divine revelation, this wronged one would never have breathed a word which might have struck terror into the hearts of the ignorant and caused them to perish. Dwelling on the glorification of him whom God shall make manifest, exalted be his manifestation, the Bab in the beginning of the Bayan saith, quote, he is the one who shall proclaim under all conditions, verily, verily, I am God. No God is there but me, the Lord of all created things. In truth, all others except me are my creatures. O my creatures, me alone do ye worship. Unquote. Likewise, in another instance, he magnifying the name of him who shall be manifest, saith, I would be the first to adore him. Now it behooveth one to reflect upon the significance of the adorer and the adored one, that perchance the people of the earth may partake of a dewdrop from the ocean of divine knowledge, and may be enabled to perceive the greatness of this revelation. The Bab, a full independent manifestation of God, says he would be the first to adore Baha'u'llah. Why? Because of the magnitude of his revelation. This is a very interesting passage. Now he says that he wouldn't have breathed a word that would have struck terror into the hearts of the ignorant and caused them to perish. And that word was, I am God. That was one of them that the clergy really got excited about. They still get very excited about it in Persia. They quote that all the time to say, look, did you ever hear anything from Muhammad like this? Baha'u'llah says, I am God. This is right here. I am God. This man said, I am God. Blasphemy. Kill them. This is the whole spirit of get after them. Then they explain that, no, it means the voice of divinity and so on. Then they even have one, they found one verse from Baha'u'llah. He says, there is no God but this solitary prisoner. Oh my goodness, what to do with that one? Very challenging. Again, it's in the same spirit. For us, there really is no God but that solitary prisoner. In that sense, he is the face of God. He is God for us in this day. But we understand there's a difference. Now, from the tablets of Baha'u'llah, we have an interesting explanation from him. He says, in the past, the divines were perplexed over this question, a question which he was the sovereign truth hath during the early years of his life himself heard them ask repeatedly. So Baha'u'llah has heard the clergy asking this thing. This is what they asked. What is that word which the Qa'im will pronounce whereby the leaders of religion are put to flight? Because they promised that the Qa'im would pronounce a word and everybody would flee. Now Baha'u'llah says, say, that word is now made manifest, and ye have fled, ere ye heard it uttered, although you perceive it not. And that blessed, that hidden, that concealed and treasured word is this. He hath now appeared in the raiment of I. He who was hidden from the mortal eyes, exclaimeth, lo, I am the all manifest. This is the word which hath caused the limbs of disbelievers to quake. Glorified be God. All the heavenly scriptures of the past attest to the greatness of the day, the greatness of this manifestation, the greatness of his signs, the greatness of his word, the greatness of his constancy, the greatness of his preeminent station.
How does that relate to Sahara's assertion that she is the word which the
Qa'im is worshipped? Well, as evidently that is another meaning of it, or at least she decided that would be the meaning of it on that occasion, and it fit. But we have Baha'u'llah stating it here. So instead of he is God, Huwa Allah, Anna Allah, I am God, he says, changes the he to I, and this is the thing that causes all this consternation. And of course it raises... That's from the Tablets of Baha'u'llah, pages 258 and 259. Now, I'm dwelling a little bit on this because in the attacks that will come against the faith in the future, this will be one of the fronts. There will be two fronts. One will be the sovereignty that Baha'u'llah has invested in the Commonwealth and in the House of Justice. That will be a challenge they will all hurl their darts at, because this is a power that they've never seen the like of on the face of the earth. And the other is this question that Baha'u'llah says he's God. How can a prophet say he's God? Michael. Yes. That's one of the explanations that you have to give. In other words, you have to be able to explain this. But you also have to be able to explain that when he says, I am God, it's because he is in a state of utter self-effacement, and he is a mirror, and he is the mouthpiece of God. Not that he, Mirza Hossein Ali, is God, all of God, embodied in a person. Because we don't believe that. And we don't believe any of the manifestations of God were that. So this is something there has to be an explanation to ease the tension. The tensions will be great on this point, I think. Now, my personal feeling, whether it's imagination or not, I feel that we will pass beyond that. And then we will celebrate the divinity that's appeared in this day. That is, as the cause becomes the dominant religion, the meaning of the day of God will become clearer to the people. What a day we've been born in, that the prophet of God came and said, I am God, I am God, I am God. What a time we is that he could just unveil himself like that and with all his beauty shatter us all and draw us into his arms. But we've never had anything like this. And then the people will celebrate. We're in the day of God, the day of God. Why do they call this over and over the day of God? Yes, in a sense, all of the appearance of the manifestation of God is the day of God. And particularly, it's the day of God for those people. But they all referred to one special day of God, the magnitude of the revelation of which is not to be compared with anything Jesus gave us or any of the other prophets gave us. It's incomparable. Even the amount of scripture of Baha'u'llah is greater than the combined scriptures of all the past dispensations. And the light he's revealed makes of Mullah Hussein, the light of the Bab even, makes of Mullah Hussein the same station as Muhammad. A disciple becomes the equivalent in power, in spiritual power, not of the station of the prophet, but in his spiritual power to the previous manifestation. How is this?
In the Quran also he said that the promised one, the one who will come, he will come, his station will be the Maqam al-Mahmud, the greatest station for the Muslim, for the next one. He'll be the station, will be supreme station. And on other place he said that the God himself will come. So whenever in our country, in whom that they are, you're claiming, especially Muslim, that Baha'u'llah is God himself. So we are saying in Quran he says that he will come himself. So we are not saying anything lies.
That isn't there. But we also explain, you can relieve this thing also by saying, but also Baha'u'llah is very clear that this doesn't mean that the Prophet of God, the Messenger of God, is all of God. He is the face of God and he has this station to speak from that voice. But we should know that the innermost essence of essences is still in his own state, in his own condition. Day of God, my goodness. Now, Abdu'l Baha explains we won't see the Prophet of God in that station, in that condition, for 500,000 years again. And I suppose we won't be here then to see it. So Michael.
Do my say in that station?
Well, we're also told that the magnitude of his shadow, we can't even conceive the magnitude of the shadow that Baha'u'llah is destined to cast over the rest of this period of 500,000 years. In other words, his power sufficeth to generate everything that's going to come afterwards. The manifestations will appear under his shadow, deriving inspiration from his spirit. It's not something we clearly can understand yet, because we've had a different scheme of things up to now. They'll be independent, full independent manifestations of God, but the looking back to Baha'u'llah will be there. It's obvious for all of this period, you know.
Isn't it that whenever new manifestation appears, it's shedding more light upon the people than the manifestations before? Doesn't that mean also that when the next manifestation appears after Baha'u'llah in 1,000 years, whenever it's going to be exactly, that this next manifestation is going to shed even more light than Baha'u'llah? Like more, I don't know, more writings, more revelations?
That's a question I don't know how to answer, because that is one of the mysterious things, how this revelation is the most great revelation, and a revelation of this magnitude will not come again. But each prophet of God, of course, carries humanity forward another stage, but somehow it's within the embrace of Baha'u'llah's universal cycle. I suppose we'd have to have the perspective of 3 or 4 dispensations to see it, to understand it.
Isn't it like
of them deriving inspiration from his revelation, from his day. It's as if they will be raised up with brighter light. You know, they will give further light, but it will be derived from this energy of which we're not able to tap into yet, because we're still at the very early stages and we're too primitive, if you will, for the all that's been revealed in this time.
Even if we study the comparatively all the revelations, only 150 years, how much the world has developed in this age, in the age of Baha'u'llah, we can't see ourselves that how much it will be developed after 1,000 years.
No, we
so
can't.
That's one of the things to see, that how it will become and what will be the difference in the next age, in the next dispensation, whatever it will be.
It's important to make this difference between the body and the soul. So, for example, I understand this when Baha'u'llah says, I am God, that his spirit,
yes,
and just his spirit and his thoughts are God's spirit, and not the body, or could you combine
yes.
it?
No, you can't combine it. You're absolutely right. Not even his person, not even his soul, his individual soul, which is a mirror of that voice, so to speak, of that power.
And that makes often a trouble for people to understand it, because what does it mean, I am God? You always see persons and bodies and not
God. Yes, yes. No, and this is the point that we're discussing here, is that we should be ready to answer this without being upset or challenged when they say, well, how can you believe in a man that's God? That a man is God, you know?
Well, when we're talking about Jesus or Christ, so we're mentioning two different names, Jesus and Christ. Can you compare it like this, that you say Christ was God, was the soul of God, was God, the spirit of God himself, and Jesus was the normal man, as everybody saw him and talked to him and whatever, and could touch him. And but when you later on compare these different steps of the different manifestations, can you see a development and say, well, the spirit of the next one is another one, is a higher one than the spirit of Christ? Or can you also say that there's no difference between the different bodies of those people? I mean, is there a different developing of those manifestations as souls and as spirit and as bodies?
You know, previously we've been looking at this, that says all the messengers of God are the embodiments of the divine attributes, of all the divine attributes. That from our point of view, if we don't distinguish that particular quality in the manifestation, he may not have been called on to reveal it. It doesn't mean he doesn't possess it. And there's this an explanation also that says that that if the people had been in the condition they were, or if this had, this time had been as in the time of Christ, then Christ would have revealed this revelation. It isn't that they couldn't have. So in that sense, they're not less than Baha'u'llah from that point of view. But in the question, it's the question of they weren't called on by God with this specific. They were given other limitations and told to give this message and this particular mission they had. And they carry these particular titles. So this is the thing that distinguishes. But he says, be careful you make any distinction between any of them, on the other hand. And even those that come under his shadow will be part of this arrangement, hierarchical arrangement that God has willed, you know. But there will still be the face of God amongst men. There will still be the... Their stations are equal in the sense that they... Their inner station, the station of the essence of all of them, is one. It doesn't change, you know. That's mysterious in itself. He says we aren't able to penetrate understand this magnitude of the influence that his shadow will cast on future manifestations. It seems it's like, I don't know, it's like the supreme drawing power or something that they're all connected to, those of the past as well as those of the future, because he says none of them of the past would have appeared if it weren't for this appearance. It's like it's working up to appear in its fullness, and then there's this, because everything in this world is cyclic, you know. We've had this sun of August, September comes and it's the same sun, but it's not August, it's not as hot as August. And then so on. We have to wait till it goes around the full cycle, and then it comes back to August again. Although the sun is the same. Seems it's kind of like that seasonal influence, you know. Maybe all through the winter we're eating the fruits that were raised up and ripened by the August sun. Unfold other things that are implicit in the revelation but that we haven't understood. If Baha'u'llah takes time to explain the verses of past manifestations, how much more one can imagine the future prophets referring to his verses and his books. You could make a compilation about this, I Am God. You'll find it very interesting. Find the different sections where he claims this. For instance, in the dispensation, he's quoted by Shoghi Effendi, "When I contemplate, O my God, the relationship that bindeth me to Thee, I am moved to proclaim to all created things, verily, I am God. And when I consider my own self, lo, I find it coarser than clay." This is his human station. He's seeing the two stations. When he considers one, he says it's lower than dust. The other, he's demonstrating humility here, yes. But also, it's not just humility because it's the reality of the two stations. In other words, the individual vehicle of this revelation from God, compared to the revelation itself, is coarser than clay, so to speak. It's made of physical matter, if you will. Then another quote from the dispensation. Not is seen in my temple but the temple of God, and in my beauty but his beauty, and in my being but his being, and in myself but his self, and in my movement but his movement, and in my acquiescence but his acquiescence, and in my pen but his pen, the mighty, the all praised. There hath not been in my soul but the truth, and in myself not could be seen but God. It's a very powerful passage too. That's quoted in the dispensation of Baha'u'llah. It's in the section on Baha'u'llah where he's quoting from the Surat al-Haykal. It's from the Haykal. I don't have the page number here with me. Greenings, page 44. He says, on whom are ye gazing? This is your Lord, the God of mercy. Gleanings, page 29. This is the day whereon naught can be seen except the splendors of the light that shineth from the face of thy Lord, the gracious, the most bountiful. Verily we have caused every soul to expire by virtue of our irresistible and all-subduing sovereignty. We have then called into being a new creation as a token of our grace unto men. I am verily the all-bountiful, the Ancient of Days. You should go back to page 103 too. He talks about this distinction between the manifestations. Remember, he says there, all else besides these manifestations live by the operation of their will and move and have their being through the outpourings of their grace. This is the day of God Himself. Fear ye God and be not of them that have disbelieved in Him. So Baha'u'llah is telling us that he has in a sense bowed to the wishes of his herald, that under all conditions, in all circumstances, he would speak with this highest voice to humanity. This is one of the reasons he gives there. Otherwise, he also is disinclined to startle people with such a claim. Now, you remember what we're reading here. It talks about divinity, lordship, prophethood, messengership, guardianship, apostleship, or servitude. With regard to the question of guardianship, some of the friends have thought, well, that must mean then that the guardian is also divine in character. What does this have to do with that? We have a letter from Shoghi Effendi on this subject. Here's where I have this quote from the epistle. Good. This is from the epistle, page 41. Divinity, whenever I mention it, divinity meaning Godhead, indicateth my complete and absolute self-effacement. This is the station in which I have no control over mine own weal or woe, nor over my life, nor over my resurrection. And that other quotation, I'm coarser than clay, is in, it's found in World Order of Baha'u'llah in the dispensation on page 113, if you want to take note of. You can find it in the World Order of Baha'u'llah letters, page 113. The question addressed to the Shoghi Effendi was, is there any reference to Abdu'l-Bahá or to the institution of the guardianship in the following quotation? The one we were reading there about divinity and lordship and so on. Also, are there any manifestations to whom the titles of servitude have been particularly applied? Shoghi Effendi answered, the passage you have quoted from the Agan refers to the prophets only and not to the guardianship. All divine manifestations have a station of servitude, and the latter does not apply to one or some of them to the exclusion of the rest. Any other points there that you'd like to talk about? Up to page 181. It's a heavy theme. All right, let's go on a little. It says here, on 181 at the bottom, those words uttered by the luminaries of truth must needs be pondered, and should their significance be not grasped, enlightenment should be sought from the trustees of the depositories of knowledge, that these may expound their meaning and unravel their mystery. Shoghi Effendi says in a letter, we cannot be sure to whom Baha'u'llah refers as the trustees of knowledge. Now we move on. If you have the outline here, we can look back at the outline for the subjects that are listed here. Page 182. Manifestation as the source of all knowledge, 182 to 184. It gives an explanation concerning new moons and the spirit and the meaning of knowledge, 183, 184, again. Yes.
The question is, trustees of the depositories of knowledge. You said that Shoghi Effendi said that he didn't know who this could be.
He says, Baha'u'llah, we cannot be sure to whom Baha'u'llah refers as the trustees of knowledge.
Okay, but as I understand it, this trustees of knowledge, of the depositories of knowledge, I would understand like this, that there is somebody in telling the people the meanings of the writings of Baha'u'llah. But doesn't it refer, to my opinion, it would refer to the Universal House of Justice to describe or explain people what this special quotation of Baha'u'llah over and means.
Mm-hmm.
Is it right?
I'm sure. I don't know if he says we don't know.
I mean,
you have an opinion. I have an opinion. It can be
trustees
of knowledge. I don't know. Trustees of the depositories of knowledge.
But doesn't it mean explaining the writings? Or
yes, but if it were just that, why would Shoghi Effendi said we cannot be sure to whom he refers? So he leaves it mysterious.
Okay.
You know, because other places he says, this is a reference to the house of justice. So clearly, you know, when he wants to say it, he says it. But here he leaves it obscure. No, it's not incumbent. It's not even within their sphere. They cannot interpret the way the guardian interpreted. They can elucidate for those things that are causing difficulty. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, well, what does the 14th hidden word mean? It means who's the center of the cause, or how should we relate, you know, in certain matters that will affect the administration and covenant of the cause. They're in a position to pronounce, as they had to in the case of the guardianship. Something so fundamental as that. They had to elucidate and say, here we have the testament of Abdu'l-Bahá. It says that a successor to Shoghi Effendi can be named under these conditions. And now they say, we find no way to appoint a successor or to legislate to make the appointment of a successor to Shoghi Effendi possible under these conditions of the will. So they can't change it. They themselves found no way. You can't understand it to the degree that you can pronounce authoritatively to others what it means. Doesn't mean we won't have access to the meanings. We can understand all kinds of things. We can be inspired to understand all kinds of things. But we can never be sure. You know, we can be satisfied in ourselves. It's just as if, you know, you read this passage this way now, and then you go and serve the cause for 5 years, you read it again, you get something quite different out of it. You'll get more out of it than you have now. Because the human spirit is changing and developing and so on. But we can never be sure. But that's all right. There's plenty of room for us to discuss what we feel, you know. Now, if we didn't have this letter from the guardian, we could all have different ideas about what this may mean. And one of them might be true. But we have this letter that says, we cannot be sure. We really cannot be sure then, with this particular point. You know? You know that the prophets of God, but then he says the luminaries of truth, they have to be pondered and then refer to the trustees. So obviously it's not the prophets.
Didn't Baha'u'llah say earlier on in Adhan that only the prophets can really say certain what?
Explain the meanings. Yeah. Well, he doesn't limit it that much, because then how do we have Abdu'l-Bahá and Shoghi Effendi? Huh? Maybe only the prophets can reveal the meanings of the past verses as distinct from interpreting their meanings. I don't know.
And to which extent should we dwell on questions like this then? He says that he even doesn't know.
Well, it's not. I think it's not. When you have something specifically stated like this, it's not worth spending too much time on it. Because I mean, how are you going to find out?
Yeah.
You
know?
And the thing about it also that they can have all those meanings, perhaps. The light of the same hidden word will reflect differently in your thoughts as in somebody else's thoughts. It doesn't mean that if we become detached and spiritual that we won't come to common understanding. We will. There'll still be a difference, but we become much closer to our understanding of the writings as we become deepened and knowledgeable. You know? Because then you are definitely interested in knowing exactly what everything says and in trying to understand that. And we should listen to each other because we have different thoughts, and some of our thoughts we will recognize that somebody else has a thought that opens another part of this, opens another meaning to this that we hadn't thought of. But as we hear it, it strikes us as that seems fine too. You know? But we always have to make a distinction between what are our discoveries, our spiritual discoveries, and the discoveries of our friends and fellow believers, and what is an authoritative explanation in the text. Somebody else had their hand up. Okay. Okay.
Isn't there the danger of splitting in the faith? That somebody says, well, this is my opinion and this is my faith, and the other one is coming, no, this is my opinion and this is my faith.
No, because the faith says your opinion is worth nothing. I mean, it's worth something as an individual opinion, but that's all. So it doesn't become binding on the community. You can't demand a following for it, because the faith doesn't allow such a thing. The faith says that the individual interpretations of the believers are not authoritative nor binding. It doesn't say we're forbidden for doing it, but nobody else has to follow it, and even the believer should be careful of his own opinions. So in a sense, it allows for a wide variety of understandings. But now, if you say that the meaning of the verse in the Akdas, that the after me cling ye to the most great branch, the ancient root, he was branched from the ancient root. If you say, well, this refers to somebody other than Abdu'l-Bahá, then that becomes an interpretation. If you want to impose it on anybody, you'll find yourself in difficulty. We'll be in difficulty. That will cause a difference. But the difference won't be a split of the faith. It will be a split off of the person who's insisting on their own opinion. And people who insist on their own opinions very shortly start fading out of the cause. But the cause remains. And they don't have following, really. I mean, you know, they sometimes go dig up other believers that haven't been Baha'is. Not very much. They don't do that very successfully either. They're motivated by desire for leadership, and it doesn't come to anything. So the cause is protected. I mean, this is lovely that I don't need to be upset because someone here says the meaning of this is this. It's all right, that's your view. You're welcome to your view. I'm glad you have a view. I'm glad you're thinking about it. And we oftentimes hear each other. You probably sit here tonight and say, goodness me, some of the things this fellow says, I can't agree with at all. You should do that. You shouldn't say, House of Justice member, I should swallow this. Because I'm sitting here talking to you about my understanding of the teachings. You know, you should be careful to not think this is the voice of the House of Justice or anything else. These are opinions, views. Now, I think I'm trying to guide you from this passage to that passage because I found this useful and share it, and that's kind of the foundation of what we're doing here. But you could go home and find other passages that are more significant and more meaningful and explain more things to you about this. I hope you'll do that. You know? Or maybe you know of a letter from the Guardian or something that explains that just the opposite of what I've told you. Then tell me. Quote it, bring it. It's such an ocean of things, you know. We keep trying to gather all the pieces and what we want to do is understand it, not impose our understanding. That would be the thing, you know? So even before, as we're teaching in classes and things, we should recognize that our view of it's going to be limited. And yet, that limited view is better than no view at all. And it will be very significant and important for you to form similar understandings, and to when you go to teach the cause, because we have to represent the writings. As we become like the book, you know, we should become like the book. The believer should be a reflection of the book. If you look in the believer, you see the book. If you look at the book, you see the qualities of the believer. Go forth with that. It's challenging. I'd like to sit here and think that I could give you all the answers. That would be lovely. But if I was so inspired, then this is not the case. Well, I think that this is time has also passed. This has brought us to the end of this. we have a section in the middle here about Haji Mirza Karim Khan, and very shortly after that we come to one of the most celebrated passages of the Quran, the passage related to the true seeker, qualifications of the true seeker. We will surely get to that. I think we will get to that next week. It'll bring us up. For that, that's 192. We're on 182 at the bottom now. We're at the top. 10 pages more, and we'll be to this passage. So you may want to read 182 to 192, or beyond that even a little bit, if you're reading along with us in the class. And if you note down anything that you want to ask that maybe we can find answers for, let us know. Challenging a theme for anybody to think about.